John Pfeffer. Welcome to KABU here in Portland, Oregon.
Thanks for having me on the show.
John Pfeffer is Director of Foreign Policy and Focus at the Institute for Policy Studies. He's written a great deal, articles, books, does interviews. For 2 years, he traveled in Eastern Europe and East Asia as an international representative for the American Friends Service Committee. His book, Aftershock, A Journey into Eastern Europe's Broken Dreams, that's Z Books, 2017, examines how the years of free market reforms have failed to deliver prosperity. Indeed, delivered corruption and organized crime in Eastern Europe, including the Ukraine. And he noted the early optimism in Eastern Europe gave way to bitterness and invigorated nationalism. Even so, he shows that against stiff odds, hope remains for the region's future. So he was really abundantly prepared for examining the Russian invasion of the Ukraine and has several articles in Foreign Policy and Focus on it. Russia is an authoritarian country run by kleptocrats and deserves no sympathy. But the U.S. drive for world domination include promises to Russia to not invite the former states of the Soviet Union into the North Atlantic Treaty Organization after the Soviet collapse. The Russians and all of them and the Russian people are afraid of another German invasion, German and Western invasion. Millions have been killed in Russia in the last 100 years. State after state, though, was invited and joined. Happening again and again, the broken promises were a precipitating factor for Russia's invasion. That the Ukraine, with its very long border with Russia, might get an invitation, that was the last straw. For those of you sickened by Russian shelling of Ukraine, be sure to avoid YouTube videos showing how the U.S. military in Iraq absolutely flattened the city of Fallujah. Documented Iraqi deaths from military operations totaled over 175,000. That's before the U.S. withdrew 20 years later. And really, who knows how many died anonymously out in the provinces and the poor neighborhoods of Baghdad. This war, of course, is new, but its repercussions and dangers are global. Russia could use what are called battlefield nuclear weapons, and the U.S. has them too. Arms budget Russia if it gets terribly desperate. Not impossible. Arms budgets are increasing across the major countries, and it seems a new Cold War is emerging. Very worrisome. Ukraine produces over 10% and Russia near 20% of the world exports of grain. Famine looms across the planet. And scientists in desperation tell us global warming is accelerating, that we risk the moment, perhaps soon, when the warming process becomes self-reinforcement and temperatures rise uncontrollably to make most of the planet uninhabitable. This is not science fiction, even if the world's elites don't want to face it because it would undermine their wealth and power. Immediately ending this war and focusing on our human priorities, these are actually absolute necessities that we want to survive, we might try that out. John Pfeffer points out that a settlement is very possible, and we discuss its terms. We also discuss what can be done in the U.S. and globally to force the elites and war industry into that settlement. First, John, the terms and provisions of that settlement.
So the current negotiations are between Kiev and Moscow, between Ukraine and Russia. And at the end of April, or actually it's beginning of April, Ukraine presented a kind of 10-point approach that introduced such things as neutrality for the country. In other words, Ukraine would not join NATO, would not join any other security pacts. And that's kind of a major sticking point. That, of course, as I said, was one of the reasons why Putin launched the invasion in the first place, to take NATO off the agenda. But the sticking point is what kind of neutrality? And Ukraine says that it could agree to neutrality, but it would only do so if it got certain security guarantees. And those security guarantees look a lot like what a NATO membership would give you. In other words, a pledge by key powers to come to Ukraine's defense if it were invaded. So that's probably not something that Russia is going to agree to, but we'll see. That's the major sticking point there. Russia has a rather maximalist approach to what it would consider peace, or what it would consider an appropriate end to this particular conflict. Russia wants to consolidate its territorial gains. As I said, it took control of Crimea. It has had de facto control over the Donbass, although prior to the invasion, it only controlled about somewhere around 30 or 35% of the Donbass in terms of the total territory. I think it aspires to control all of the Donbass, so all of Donetsk and Luhansk provinces, which would give it access to a lot of territory and a lot of natural resources. But it goes beyond that. Russia, it seems, also wants to consolidate its control over the southern reaches of Ukraine. It has seized control of the town of Kherson, really the only major town that it managed or has managed so far to take control of. But it is very close to having total control over Mariupol, the southern port, or what remains of Mariupol after nonstop Russian shelling. It aspires, of course, to move further west and take control of Odessa as well. In other words, basically turning Ukraine into a landlocked country, no access to ports. This would also serve the purpose of creating a land bridge between the Crimean Peninsula and Russia proper. So those are kind of territorial, those territorial ambitions. Again, not easy to negotiate with Ukraine. Ukraine's not going to want to give up, certainly not the territory it has lost as a result of the invasion, and not even the earlier losses such as Crimea, even if it does not have any current prospects of retaking that territory. Where the United States comes in, well, the United States would be a kind of key guarantor of security in any kind of agreement. But other than that, the United States doesn't play a major role here. I mean, yes, it is supplying Ukraine with a lot of weaponry. It is leading the sanctions against Russia. So, yes, in terms of the overall environment, the United States has kind of an effective veto over certain agreements. But the real kind of nub, the real challenge here in terms of a negotiated settlement is resolving this conflict between the territorial ambitions of Russia and the willingness of Ukraine to entertain neutrality and what kind of neutrality that looks like. Some of the other issues, such as the composition of the Ukrainian government, Russia has said that it wants to denazify Ukraine, which is frankly a ridiculous demand, given the nature of the Ukrainian government and its Jewish leader. But I suspect that that won't be part of any kind of negotiated settlement. Possibly the disposition of Ukraine's military will be considered part of the issue of neutrality. But it will all ultimately boil down to, again, as I said, this conflict between Russia's territorial ambitions and Ukrainians' willingness to entertain some form of neutrality.
Yeah, I read it somewhere that land for peace compromises, they're imperfect and unprincipled in some ways. Giving, bribing the aggressor, and they sometimes lead to even more demands. But this land for peace option is reasonable, and in the larger scheme of things, not unjust. But it won't be negotiated without pressure from the outside, and especially in the U.S. to have a peace movement joined by the far larger climate action forces. That's a necessity. My sense is that climate action, they're recognizing that a new Cold War is emerging, wasting vast resources needed for successful climate action. So, John Pfeffer, what do you see as the possibilities for pushing both sides? Indeed, China may well push the Russians to agree to something much, much less than they sought. What's the possibilities of that push to occur and succeed, for that pressure to occur and succeed?
Well, here in the United States, you know, the public opinion polls suggest that a very large majority of people both support sanctions against the Russian government, but also do not want the United States to be involved directly in a war. So this is kind of the middle ground for your average American. In terms of putting pressure on the U.S. government, I mean, the U.S. government, you know, it certainly needs more pressure to move in a climate-friendly direction. It's not so much pressure on the Biden administration, of course, but pressure on Congress and on key members of Congress to push through climate-related provisions in the Build Back Better bill. But in terms of on Ukraine policy, I mean, to be honest with you, I disagree with much of the U.S. U.S. peace movement's position, because the U.S. peace movement has generally taken a rather inadvertently supportive position of the Russian government. In other words, there are very few people in the U.S. peace movement who would come out and say that they support Moscow in its current invasion of Ukraine. But by opposing any kind of U.S. military assistance to Ukraine, they're effectively supporting Russian military efforts.
In their defense, they do call for nonviolent resistance, complete non-cooperation. And Ukraine's diverse people have shown such intelligence, ingenuity, and bravery and solidarity that it might well force the Russians to negotiate. The peace movement, though, it's so weak right now, and we need widespread upsurge from all justice and climate action forces to critique both imperial forces, the U.S. and Russia, China, not just the United States effort to dominate, and, of course, to negotiate a settlement to this war and use our very ample resources to save the planet and our what we call civilization.
But in terms of putting pressure on other actors, I mean, you know, the actor that is the aggressor in this situation, Russia, is the one that is perhaps the one that's most vulnerable to pressure. The sanctions are having an impact on the Russian economy. They're having an impact on Russia's ability to continue its war effort by making it more difficult for Russian armament industry to supply and source the components for major weapon systems. And, of course, the Russian army itself has sustained great losses and has rather low morale at this point. So there are pressure points here, and I think Russia is vulnerable. But of course, we don't want to push Russia into an absolute corner where it feels like it has nothing to lose and therefore has to either keep fighting in Ukraine in order to show some degree of success, or feels compelled to escalate and, you know, use weapons of mass destruction. So we want to avoid that as well. So it's a delicate balance, of course, putting sufficient pressure on Russia for it to end its current military engagement in Ukraine, and yet not so much pressure as to force the government there to act in extremely counterproductive ways.
John Pfeffer, thanks a lot for talking to us today.
No problem. It was a pleasure.